Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Kabbalah and Coffee. I want to begin with Happy Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day for all of the moms here and for all of us. All of us have moms. I'm assuming if we're here, we have a mom, right? So Happy Mother's Day. Always a very special day and always special to be here together studying Kabbalah. Now, today's topic is the Kabbalah of comedy. Now, you might think, what does Kabbalah have to say about comedy? Well, I'm glad you asked. So, in fact, according to Kabbalah, the secret of the universe, answering life's biggest question, which I think life's biggest question is, why are we here? I think that's like always a big question, right? Why are we here? It boils down to comedy. And I'll explain. So, Kabbalah teaches that God created the world in order to have a home here on earth. In other words, God could have whatever home he wants, right? So God could, when I say home, I don't mean a physical home, obviously, but I mean a space that's conducive, that is transparent, if you will, to his will and to his wishes and to his ideologies, etc., or his essence. Now, God could have created and has created many spaces that are attuned to that. And yet, what God wanted is to create a space that is, at least on the surface, hostile to godliness, and then for us to come in and make it conducive. In other words, we're meant to transform an otherwise hostile environment into a holy environment. And in doing so, the Kabbalists teach, we create comedy. Because what is comedy? If you boil it down, what makes funny funny? What makes things funny?
Have irony.
Irony, right? And so the way it's described in Kabbalah is comedy is always at the intersection of what should happen and what is happening. In other words, when the unexpected happens, the last thing you thought is happening, then that is comedy. Which is, by the way, why there's such a thin line between tragedy and comedy. Because tragedy is also the last thing that you saw coming in a negative way, and comedy hopefully is you know, in a positive way, you know, a punchline gets you and makes you laugh because you weren't expecting it. If you were expecting the punchline, you probably are not going to laugh as much. If you've already heard the joke, it's not as funny. The power of humor happens when you're not expecting, when you least expect it, right? I mean, that's what makes things funny. Trying to think of some good jokes that bring out this idea. Think of any joke that you like. It always boils down to something unexpected that catches someone, you know, for a loop. Okay, so that's comedy. Comedy is when the unthinkable happens, or when the unforeseeable happens, or when the unexpected indeed happens. And so Kabbalah says this is the understanding of. This explains why creation, at its core, is all about comedy. You see, what God wants is for a material, physical world to become divine and godly. For inherently egoistic, narcissistic, self-centered, not in a bad way, but just in a real way, right? For human beings that are essentially, good morning, essentially egotistic or egoistic and narcissistic and self-serving and self-centric and self-identifying, for people that naturally begin in a self-oriented fashion to become selfless and to live for a higher purpose. For somebody, instead of living for themselves, to live for another human being or to live for a higher purpose. I mean, that's something that you don't expect to happen. And that's something that causes God joy and humor. This is an example that I've given before. The specific comedic example that's brought in Kabbalah is a talking bird. How talking birds, like a parrot, or a what else talks? Parakeet. I feel like there's more. Yes. But they're usually dusty from all the coal. Anyway. That's a canary, right? So Kabbalah brings the example of a talking bird and says that a king sometimes will ask for his servants to bring him a talking bird, a tzipor hamedaberet, a talking bird. Why? In order to be amused, in order to be to be uplifted, if he's in not in the best mood. So this will bring him joy. Because you don't expect, where's the unexpected with the bird? Because you don't expect the bird to talk. For a human being to talk, good morning. For a human being to talk, it's not so novel, right? It's not so unexpected. Now, when a little kid talks, it's also amusing. For a little kid to say sophisticated things, it'll make you smile. It's like, wow, that kid is saying this stuff. How cute, right? Because it's unexpected. For an adult to say mature things, not a big deal. For a bird to speak, that's something amazing. That's something cool. And that's something that brings pleasure and joy and makes us laugh. And so the king wants the talking bird. The same thing is, not that we're God's talking birds, but Kabbalah says that this explains, at least partially, why God created this universe, why God created all of this. And it's essentially to experience the joy of the talking bird, which is that which shouldn't be happening. Human beings that should be self-centered, human beings that should be all into themselves and not thinking about something higher, actually living higher, that is something that gives God intense pleasure. Is somebody knocking over there? Can you check quickly to see if that front room is...
A bunch of kids are in the way.
Yeah, check if they need to get in. And then, if you don't mind, close the door otherwise. Close these doors.
Yeah, I saw the teacher coming.
Okay, yeah, so... All right, so if you boil it down, what that means is that creation actually is intended, or comedy is at the core of creation. God creates the world in order for this surprising, amusing impossibility to actually happen. So this is at the core of the universe, the core of creation, the core of existence. Which is why, perhaps, we love comedy. Now, we love comedy, I think, because it lifts us up. But on a spiritual level, comedy at its core is the juxtaposition of two opposites. And we're meant to live this juxtaposition. We're meant to live in a state where it would seem like we should be acting one way. And at the last minute, boom, we act the other way. We're meant to be living with this idea of comedy, of humor. Now, I would say this, that as human beings, so comedy is one of those things that transcends people. In other words, there are a lot of things that divide us, that separate us, right? A lot of things that are very particular. I like this, you like that, right? Different cultures, different languages, right? There's different foods and different languages, and there are a lot of things that divide us. There are also things that unite us. I think comedy is one of those things that unites us. Now, comedy can also be dividing, but a good joke, a really good joke, can, theoretically at least, and I think practically also, transcend divides. And it can be funny on many different levels, for many different people. Comedy brings people together, yeah.
Well, something ironically struck me funny yesterday. I was watching this show. It was about Myanmar. Myanmar is... used to be Burma, and there's quite a bit of genocide going on there where they're killing people all the time. So they, CNN, whatever channel, news people were there. And they were interviewing these people who are so poverty-stricken, but they were all laughing together. And it struck me funny. I was like, even in amongst all this killing and people laugh together no matter what. They find something to laugh, even
right,
amongst different languages.
Right. And so I think what you're bringing out a great point, and that is it's not only that comedy transcends distinctions and can bring people together, but comedy can be uplifting and can be present. I think that itself is a powerful lesson.
And the tool to communicate through.
Right. It could be a tool to communicate to someone else. It can take someone out of their, you know, living in such difficult circumstances and transport them, in a sense, to a better place. It transports them to a happier place. Comedy is very powerful.
I was reading a little bit of this last night, and it said that one of the rabbis would start every class.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's where we're going with this. The power of comedy.
He would start every class with a joke, just to open up the students and make them receptive.
Exactly. So comedy has a way of communicating. First of all, you can communicate things that maybe you couldn't say otherwise in a joke, in comedy. Which is why comedy is a powerful, you know, it can be used as a powerful, you know, commentary platform. You can share ideas and you can break down, you can tear down falsities and falsehoods, and you can tear down corrupt institutions sometimes through comedy, and you can build things up through comedy. Comedy is very powerful. Comedy touches us in a deep place. I mean, who doesn't like listening to jokes? I think, I don't know.
And just not to bring up an opposite, but through people's comedy or jokes, you learn a lot about them as well.
About the person. Yeah, and that's something also that ties into the discussion here. That comedy is, it's not just a joke, but it can also reveal a lot about the person. Exactly. So comedy is a very powerful thing. So if we want to recap a little bit about the Kabbalah of comedy, so again, the construct of comedy, what makes something funny, what defines it as humorous, is the fact that you have the convergence of opposites in the same space. You didn't expect that to happen, and it's happening. It's the unexpected occurring. It's the punchline that you couldn't foresee, and now it's happening. So it's that space, it's that convergence of opposites. It's like physical humor, right? A guy is walking and then, you know, falls. There's something about physical, right? Why is physical humor funny? Again, you're not expecting it. It's Three Stooges. I don't know if it's still funny today. I don't know if it was, right? But it's, there's something that makes us laugh about these things, and it's because it's the unexpected. So, number one, the construct of comedy, according to Kabbalah, is the opposites. The original model of comedy is God's creation of the universe. The original model is God creating the universe. Why? In order to have us build a home for Him out of materials and out of things that don't seem appropriate. And, right? It doesn't seem like you can make this world a home for God. If you can make it happen, that brings God joy. That makes God smile. It's comedy. It's the unexpected happening. So we have the construct of comedy. What's at its core, the nuts and bolts of comedy? What makes something funny? We have the idea that comedy is at the core of creation. And then we have the other idea, the third point that we've mentioned up until now, which is that comedy brings people together, transcends boundaries, can lift things up, can tear down institutions that are corrupt. And comedy has a lot of power because it really goes in a deep place and it reveals a lot about the one who's telling the joke. All right. By the way, my first stand-up special is airing on Netflix in the winter. I'm joking. This is okay. It's not even, see, that wasn't funny. Now, see that? Yeah, I've seen pieces of it. Yeah, the Jewish, like, yeah. A Jewish lady back in the day.
Yeah. Anyway,
yeah.
Speaks a lot to what you're saying.
Yeah.
It's very good.
Yeah, and we, I think, listen, most of us want to laugh. We want to laugh. We like to laugh, right? I think it's powerful what Jeff said, that you can laugh even amidst very, very difficult circumstances. You look at a lot of the people that survive terrible things, and you know, you see sometimes survivors and there's a twinkle in the eye, and like, it helps. It helps to be, to have that sense of joy still. Look, people that laugh and people that enjoy, you know, people that have that sense of inner joy, humor, comedy, etc., You know, studies have shown they live longer, healthier. I mean, humor and comedy and laughter and joy is it's essential to the human condition. So let's pick it up. Oh, let's pass these around. And let's pick it up right there at the beginning of chapter 2. We started last week, but I want to get a running start. So I'm going to go back a little bit, and then we'll launch into the new readings for this week. All right, I'm going to start chapter 2, page 32. And here, once again, we cite the Talmudic example of Rabbah who began his classes with a comedic statement. All right, chapter 2. The explanation of this is, our sages relate Psachim 117a, that's a Talmudic tractate. The Talmud says, before Rabbah would open to begin teaching his students, he would make a humorous remark, which would cause his students to laugh. After that, he would sit in awe and open to begin teaching his teachings. So the Talmud says that Rabbah would begin with a joke, and then he would teach. And so now Kabbalah explains what was going on here. And in the context of giving and receiving, in every relationship, just to take a step back, in every relationship, you're giving and receiving, and that's a constant ebb and flow. So here we go. The giver must open his students. In the context of teaching, you cannot just teach. If you're a student, you can't just have a cold start and begin teaching. You have to engage your students. You have to open your students. I.e., he must prepare the receiver to be fit to receive the transmission of his teachings by first exciting their senses and faculties. So the first thing the teacher has to do is get them interested and motivated to learn. Open them up. Get them excited. Then he must make another preparation to open his teachings. So the first thing you need to do is open your students, prepare the students. And then it's like the earth, right? It's like before you plant in the earth, good morning, before you plant in the earth, you can't just take a seed and drop it. I mean, you could theoretically, I guess it could grow, but you'll be more successful if you prepare the earth. If you take, you know, if you take a tool, pass it to Sandrine, please. If you take a tool and you open up the earth a little bit, you open up the earth and now you plant, it's going to take root much easier. So you have to prepare the students. But then after that, he says, you have to prepare the teachings themselves. In other words, you have to aim your lesson, your teaching, your message to fit the students. You still can't, even if you've made a joke, you can't teach over their heads. You have to make it accessible. So that's the second preparation. It says, then he must make another preparation to open his teachings, which entails ensuring that his teachings are measured according to the faculties of the students. Let's continue page 34. Therefore, before he opened his students, which is preparation number one, to prepare them to be ready to receive his teachings, Rabbah would make a humorous remark. So there's two preparations that a teacher must do. So here we have teaching 101. The first thing is, you can't teach a student cold. So what we do here is, sometimes I start with a joke, but every time we start with bagels and coffee. That's a good way to get everybody warmed up and open, hopefully, open to learning or something, right? So you're prepared. The students have to be ready to learn. They can't be like this, arms folded, you know, like, I don't know that I'm interested. I don't know that I want to be here. It's not a conducive start. You're not going to take anything in like that. So you have to be open, you have to be engaged. And then you have to take the lesson, take the information, and make it accessible, make it relevant. But the first thing is you have to work on the student, that connection. How did Rabbah build that connection? He did it with comedy. Because comedy gets into someone, and it gets them to be open, it lifts them up, and it opens them up. According to Kabbalah, which we'll read in a moment, comedy actually opens the mind and opens creative wisdom and creative thought. To be open to listening to a new idea that your teacher is going to teach you, you can't be stuck in a pattern of thinking of, I know everything that there is to know. In other words, if you're in a place in your head, in your own head, where you're thinking, I know everything, and this person is not really telling me anything new, then you're not going to learn. You have to be in a space that you're open to learning, that you're curious to learn. What brings out that curiosity? Comedy. On multiple levels. Number one, when you laugh, the barriers are broken. Your inner barriers are being broken down. You're not as stiff, right? You're not as stiff as you were. You're more open. So once you're more open, you're more fluid. So now you're more open to taking things in. But also, what is a joke? We said it before. What is a joke? It's the unexpected. If you're open, the moment you hear a punchline, I didn't expect it, now you could be open to more things that are unexpected. You with me? The comedy itself is a microcosm of what teaching is. Because if comedy means that the unexpected is happening, a juxtaposition between the expected and the unexpected, so what you're telling the student through a joke is, you like that joke, you didn't see it coming, good, I have more things that you haven't seen coming. Right? There's more wisdom that you don't know. So on two levels, comedy helps the student. On a personal level, this is aside from the wisdom that you're imparting as a teacher. Just on a human connection level, preparing the student to connect with them. Number one, comedy breaks down barriers. We're laughing, we're engaged. We're laughing, we're not sitting so stiffly in our seats. We're not afraid, we're not nervous, we're not anxious, we're not upset, we're laughing, so we're open on a basic level. On a deeper level, I'm just reiterating what I said before, on a deeper level, once you laugh at the unexpected, and now you're like, wow, I didn't see that coming, and you're open to things that are unexpected, so now you're open to learning more things that you didn't know before. And now you're open to considering that maybe you didn't know everything. Right? If you're able to laugh at a joke, it means you're open to the concept that there are things that you didn't see coming and that you don't see coming.
It's a lovely tool to use, you know, whenever you have a student, a child in your that's not into the lesson. I mean, we have two types of motivation, intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. And it's the teacher's job to get the child or the audience engaged in it if they have no interest whatsoever.
Right.
And they try to get each child and find their way. And comedy is a quick way to do that, it sounds like.
Comedy is a fantastic
and
way to do that.
Once they have that extrinsic motivation established, then you can draw that intrinsic motivation.
Right, and that's exactly where we're going with this, that although comedy creates a bond, it's not the same. The bottom line is, you're not teaching a class to deliver comedy. There's wisdom that needs to be transmitted. But you can't, it's almost like you can't, it's not almost, it's exactly like this. You can't get to the punchline, you can't get to the main feature without the opening act. It's like you have to prepare the student. You have to prepare the ground before you go in with the information. Otherwise, that's never going to get in. You have to open up before you can deliver what it is that you're there to deliver. Now, let's continue inside. This is page 34. So a lot of this over the next page or two is a little bit kind of going on. I'm not going to say it's going off on a tangent, but it's kind of like, and it's not 100% parenthetical either, but it's speaking about this concept of the joke and casual conversation as opposed to deep wisdom conversation. So let's jump into it and you'll see what I mean. All right, page 34, Inconspicuous Wisdom. Now, this humorous remark can be categorized as, quote, casual conversation, end quote, of which it says, and this is a quote also from the Talmud, that even the casual conversation of Torah sages must be learned and studied. So let's stop here for a second. The Talmud says, Afilu sichat chulin, shotamid echachamim, Tzurichim limud. Even mundane, casual, everyday, ordinary conversation of a scholar, of a sage, of a Talmud Chacham, of a Torah scholar, that also needs to be studied. Why? The implication is there's nothing casual. There's nothing accidental. There's nothing meaningless about even the casual conversation of a Torah sage. Why? Let's continue inside. Third line of the new section. Since these sayings contain great wisdom and intellectual depth. If someone is truly brilliant, and it's not only a measure of IQ here, we're talking about a Torah scholar, right? So it's not only smart, but it's dedicated to Torah and to Torah wisdom. If somebody is really a Torah scholar, then even their casual conversation will be laden with messages, with depth. Even a casual conversation will have a lot to teach us about life, about Judaism, about Torah, about wisdom, about all positive things. Let's continue inside. You'll see he's balancing this notion of, well, how deep is the joke and how shallow is the joke? He says, nonetheless, these sayings are considered to be merely an external representation of the sage. So he's qualifying the Talmudic statement. The Talmud says that you can learn and you should learn even from the casual conversation of Torah scholars, of Torah sages. Don't discount it. Don't write it off. It's just, you can learn from it. But he says here in this Kabbalistic text, although we might learn from it, it's still not the same as the wisdom itself. In other words, the wisdom from a Torah scholar, when the Torah scholar is teaching you Torah, is on a much greater level than the everyday conversation of the Torah scholar that also has wisdom. In other words, one has wisdom also, and one is directly wisdom. So the sage or the scholar that's giving a Torah class and delivering Torah, that has the pure wisdom in it. The everyday conversation from which you can glean how to speak nicely and how to speak respectfully and how to think and how, that also has wisdom that you can learn from, but it's not pure wisdom. It's auxiliary wisdom. It's here he calls it external wisdom. It's still wisdom. It's still wise. But it's not the main dish, it's a side dish. Now let's continue. Third paragraph on the page of 34. The greater the sage, the greater his casual conversation will be, from which many lofty concepts can be learned. So he says it's true. The greater the sage, the more wise even the casual conversations will be, and the more things you can learn from it. And he continues, and although these sayings represent just the, this is a quote, the fallen wisdom of the sage, it's not direct, it's kind of like what drops, you know, what falls out, they are still actual wisdom that contain much depth. As our sages say, another Talmudic statement, the statements of the sages are blessings, the statements of the sages are wealth, the statements of the sages heal. And these are not statements of Torah, but these are just random, but these are casual, everyday statements and conversations of the sages. So what we're bringing out here is this idea that's cited in, so far we have three different sources in Talmud, that even when a scholar says something that doesn't appear to be directly wisdom oriented. It's not, he's not teaching. It's an everyday conversation. It still has much wisdom, and it still contains lofty concepts, and it's still something that can be learned from. And again, look at this last statement. It's a blessing, it's wealth, and it's healing. In other words, you can glean. It's truly a blessing to experience that and to hear that. Which would mean, thus far, that Rabbah's joke itself contains much depth. Rabbah was not just sharing a joke with a good punchline. You know, it's not like Rabbah was Googling like best jokes for Torah students. It's not what was going on. Even Rabbah's casual conversation, his everyday jokes, right? Even the openers contain much wisdom. But it's not the same wisdom as the lesson itself. If Rabbah was intending today to teach an area of Jewish law, and he opens with a joke, so the point is you can learn a lot from the joke. You can learn how a Torah scholar tells a joke, how a Torah scholar thinks, how a Torah scholar thinks, how a Torah scholar articulates. There's a lot that you can learn from that. From the scholar's everyday conversation, even from the joke. But it's still not the halachic lesson. It's not the actual lesson itself. All right. Let's continue. This is still in the context of learning from the Torah scholar. Learning from the everyday conversation of a Torah scholar. Last line. This is referred to as, quote, attending to a Torah scholar. Now, in the Hebrew, it's called shimusha. Shimusha shel Torah. This is, shimush is kind of like apprenticeship. This is like the apprenticeship to a Torah scholar. Learning from their everyday conversation means you're hanging around them and you're learning not just from when they teach, but from how they are and how they live and what they say. Let's continue. Page 36. The Talmud states, in Brachot, attending to a Torah scholar is greater than studying under him. Oh, so now we're flipping it the other way. There's, turns out the Talmud says, in this place, this source of Talmud, Tractate Brachot, that when you attend to a Torah scholar, it's even greater than studying the wisdom itself. As it says, and this is a quote from the Book of Kings, it refers to the prophet Elisha. Look what it says. As it says, Elisha, son of Shaphat, is here. And who is he? Who is Elisha? Elisha is the one who poured water over the hands of Elijah. In other words, the prophet Elisha, so let me give you a little bit of the historic significance here. Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah the prophet, was one of the greatest prophets of all time. His disciple and successor was a prophet named Elisha. Elisha HaNavi. Now, Elisha is not as well known. Although Elisha has many, many miracles that are written up in Scripture, I think Elijah is more famous just simply because we say that he comes to every Brit Milah, every circumcision, every Passover Seder. We pour a cup for him, the cup of Elijah. We open up the door for him, right? We do all these ceremonies and symbolisms for Elijah. Whereas Elisha, you know, we don't hear much from him. You should know, just this is now parenthetically, the reason why Elijah comes to every Brit Milah, every circumcision, and every Seder is because Elijah said to Hashem, said to God, at one point when he was very frustrated with the Jewish people and their idolatrous ways, a lot of people were serving idols in his time. So he said, God, your people have forsaken your covenant, and I'm the only one left that still is on, you know, still is on board, on point with you. And so it's said that God says to him, really? You're the only one left? For all time, you'll go to every circumcision, every family, every parent, or parents that are bringing their child into the covenant of Abraham, into the Jewish covenant, you're going to be a witness that you're not the only one that's still sticking with the covenant. Here's another family. Here's another young boy. Go to a Seder, right? Oh, the people have forsaken your covenant. Really? They're still eating stale bread thousands of years later. Sorry, very expensive flatbread. Thousands of years later, in commemoration of the Exodus, and you're saying, you said 2,000 years 2,500 years ago, you said that they've forsaken your covenant. You're going to go to every Seder and every Bris and see for yourself that indeed the Jewish people are still connected. So that's a little bit of an aside as to...
He also never died.
He went in the chariot. Yeah, he went in the chariot. Although, like, when he comes back down, does he come back down in his body? I mean, sometimes it says that he does, but typically we understand that he's coming back and he's able to be around and... in his own way. But yeah, he went up in the chariot, famous in those chariots of fire or whatever it was. He went up in this blaze of fire. And Elisha is the one who saw him go up to heaven in the chariots. Elisha was his disciple. Elisha, by the way, the contrast between Elijah and Elisha, and I've given a class on this before, one of the JLI classes, compared and contrasted them. Elijah was very fiery. He used to give fiery almost sermons, like, the people are terrible, they're corrupt, change your ways, and I'll show you that this is the truth, and the idols are false, and I'll challenge the idolatrous priest to a showdown on Mount Carmel. Like, it was very, very, I don't know what the right word is, very, there's a lot of showmanship there, and not in a bad way, in a good way, or what, it just, that was his style. Elisha was much more quiet, and he didn't speak in such a loud way, if you will, about the challenges, about the... what some people were doing as far as serving idols. He was more loving and more caring and more sensitive. He was the one who succeeded Elijah. But as Scripture, let's get back to the text here. As Scripture describes Elisha and Elisha's approach, in whatever context this is, it says that Elisha, I'll just repeat that line, second line, Elisha, son of Shaphat, is here, who poured water over the hands of Elijah. How is he described? As the water pourer. He was his disciple. He learned to be a prophet under the tutelage of Elijah. And yet, he learned wisdom from Elijah. And yet, what do we say? We say that he is the one who attended to him. He poured water over his hands. Why mention something so mundane if you want to mention his resume? Who was Elisha? Yeah, he was the attendant. Why mention something so mundane? So the Talmud in Tractate Brachot says, attending to a Torah scholar is greater than studying under him. And it cites this verse as a proof. Let's continue. Third line at the end of the line on page 36. The verse does not attribute, this is all from the Talmud, the verse does not attribute Elisha's greatness to the fact that he studied under Elijah, but rather to his pouring water over Elijah's hands. This teaches us that attending to a Torah scholar is greater than studying under him. So now we have something that appears, you know, maybe, I don't know if it's contradictory, but at least it pulls us in another direction. Because what it's saying here is, what the Talmud is saying, is that you can learn more by being around a Torah scholar, not in their class, but being around a Torah scholar, you can learn more than being in their class. In other words, when you're in the class, you might learn that area of law or of Torah that they're teaching. But when you're hanging around them, you learn how to live. It's often been said that teachers, educators, parents, they educate or they teach, they influence more than what they say, it's who they are that really makes an influence, right? It's like you can say whatever it is, but and that has a certain type of influence, but it's really who you are that has the greatest influence. So how does the student get to know who you are? Or how does a child or how does somebody else get to know who you are? It's by hanging around. So Elisha is the one who attended to Elijah. He poured water over his hands. It's not that he became wise by pouring water. He became wise by hanging around a great prophet. When you hang around Elijah, you see how he lives. You see how he thinks. You see how he speaks. You see how he engages with other people. You see how he lives. And that creates an impression. And you can learn more from watching someone live than listening to them teach. You learn more by observing who the person is than by how well they lecture. Right? Well, it's been said the greatest lecture we can give is how we live our lives or something like that. Something along those lines. Or if not, we just created a new statement. Let's throw it in a bumper sticker, right? Sounds about right. Sounds familiar, yeah. I don't know if I heard it from someone or I was around someone and that's kind of the sense that I got. I'm kidding. The point is that by being around someone, you can learn a lot about who they are, and if they're a good person, you can learn good values. Reminds me of what a rabbi once told a student who was being critical of, you know, noticing flaws in people. And he said, look, you'll encounter many people in your life. And every person has virtues and vices, assets and liabilities, good qualities and negative qualities. And you have a choice. You can look at the negative qualities, and if you look at the negative qualities, then that's what you'll have. That's what you'll be. Because you'll tell yourself, look, this person fails in this area. So, you know, if they fail, I can fail. This person doesn't do this, doesn't do that. If you look at all of the negative qualities of every person, so then you'll have all of that. But if you look at the positive, you'll have all of that. So attending to a Torah scholar, attending to a tzaddik, a prophet, whatever it is, means that you're hanging around someone who is great, and you're looking at the positive qualities, and you're learning from them, and you're learning life lessons. And the Talmud says that you can learn perhaps more from that experience than sitting in a class that they're teaching. Nonetheless, one is direct wisdom, and one is indirect wisdom. That's probably the best way to phrase it. The class, even if you can learn more about how to live from being around the Torah scholar and not in their class, it's still indirect wisdom. It's still wisdom that's coming from how they're living their life. It's like it's indirect in a way. Whereas when you're sitting in the class and they're teaching, that's direct wisdom. That's intentional direct wisdom. And so circling back to our conversation, Rabbah opens each class of his. Rabbah opened, speaking in the past tense, Rabbah opened each class of his with a joke, a humorous remark. And for those students that experienced that comedy, it was not only funny, but it was instructive. It taught them about him, and it taught them about how he thought, and how he spoke, just how he was. And there's a lot to learn from that. Nonetheless, it's indirect wisdom. It's a joke. It's not pure, unfiltered wisdom. Whereas when Rabbah began teaching, so he started with a joke. When he began teaching, that's when the wisdom was delivered. Does this make sense? So we have both things are true. The comedy opens up and shares wisdom in an indirect way. And sometimes that indirect wisdom can be more important than the wisdom, but it's still indirect. The wisdom itself is what follows. And that's what we continue with on 36. Next paragraph. After that, the Talmud continues. Rabbah would sit in awe and begin his teachings. He explains that. Torah must be studied amidst fear of heaven. In other words, there has to be a certain respect and decorum when we study Torah. Our sages teach that just as the Jewish people received the Torah at Sinai with awe, fear, trembling, and perspiration, and these are quotes from Scripture. Hold on, let's see, where is this quote from? 46, Brachot. Maybe it's from the Talmud. So the Talmud says that when the Jews stood at Sinai, and by the way, next week, next Sunday, a week from today, is the day of the anniversary of the giving of the Torah at Sinai. So it's 3,334 years. 3,2448. What's the number? One second, was that? No. Hold on. The Jewish year was 2448, and now we're 5778. So that's 3,330. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, 3,330 years. Yeah, that's cool. So in a week from today, it will be 3,330 years to the day that we stood at Sinai, and everyone's invited. We have learning Saturday night and service and ice cream at brunch and dairy and all that stuff in the daytime next week. You can take a look at this and other stuff that I'll mention after the class. But the point of all this is that just as when we stood at Sinai, there was a sense of awe. There was a sense of respect, of decorum. In fact, look at this. Awe, fear, trembling, and perspiration. It was a very big experience, the Talmud says. So too, one must feel the same thing whenever he or she studies Torah. So just as it was then, so too it ought be now. And that is that we ought to feel that we're at Sinai and God is giving us the Torah and this is divine wisdom and this is divine law every single time we study Torah. Whether it's the legal parts of Torah or whether it's certainly the mystical parts of Torah. Studying divine wisdom, studying God's wisdom. Doing that should evoke within us a sense of tremendous awe and respect. That's why Rabbah, although he began with a joke, it quickly got into a serious situation. Just as Scripture states, by the giving of the Torah, quote, the people saw and trembled and stood from afar, end quote. Similarly, whenever one studies Torah, it must be with great subordination and fear. Now, it doesn't mean to be so afraid that you can't study, but it means to have that sense of respect, decorum, awe, like that sense of surrender to something greater than oneself in that experience. So that's how Torah needs to be studied. It needs to be in a serious way. But before the Torah student can begin studying, the teacher must open his faculties. And this is accomplished through comedy, by the teacher's humorous remark. It sounds like the opposite. It's even this is a juxtaposition of opposites. If comedy is the confluence, the convergence of opposites, this is also. You're opening up a Torah class, and a Torah class is a serious thing. Right, at least the way the Talmud describes it. You're opening up a Torah class with comedy. Makes no sense. But you need to open the students. You can't go in for the kill. Not the kill, but you can't go in with the depth of Torah without opening up the students first, and that happens through humor. Let's continue. Second to last paragraph. The humorous remark that precedes the lesson, listen to this, what does it do? It raises the students to a higher standing so that they will be able to receive and understand the teacher's lessons. So it opens them up, but also he says, it actually raises the students, it lifts them up to be able to be closer to the level of the teacher to understand what the teacher is going to teach. Let's continue. Now in our scenario, in this example of teacher and student, Rabba and his students from the Talmud, from Talmudic times, the teacher in this case is incomparably greater than the student. It is for this reason that the student must be completely subordinated before his teacher. As our sages, page 38, say, a Torah scholar who sits before his teacher and whose lips do not drip with bitter dread, dot, dot, dot. In fact, the full quote there is in footnote 50. It says, a Torah scholar who sits before his teacher and whose lips do not drip with bitter dread is destined to be singed in the fires of Gehenna. Oy, that's why it was left out here in the discourse, right? Now, typically you don't see a lot of Jewish texts talking about fires of Gehenna, the fires of hell. And here, and the Jewish understanding is not that it's a destination, but it's a cleansing process. But the point is that a student who doesn't sit with this type of subordination maybe it sounds like has a weird connotation, but with a sense of awe and respect before a teacher, before a Torah teacher. So the Talmud says it's not a good thing. So in this context, Rabba, the great teacher Rabba, teaching his students had to sit with awe and a sense of respect. So this refers to a state of complete subordination. So that's how the Torah scholar has to sit. And yet, before that happened, before that posture, there had to be the joke. And this is the function of the humorous remark, to empower the student to be able to receive the words of the teacher. Generally speaking, it opens the heart and mind of the student so that he will be a worthy recipient. Although the humorous remark merely creates an external connection between teacher and student, nonetheless, this external connection paves the way for their deeper, more internal connection, for it is specifically through the closeness initiated by the teacher telling the students a humorous remark that they can ultimately receive the internal transmission of his teachings. And so here we have what you mentioned before, the extrinsic and intrinsic connections. You have the inner and then the outer connection. You have a deeper and perhaps a less deep connection. But you need the one before you have the other. You cannot expect your students to sit there with awe and respect and subordination and openness and be ready to hear and completely throwing out everything that they've understood and be open totally to the wisdom of the teacher from a cold start. It's not going to happen. You have to open up the student, lift them up. You have to, in a sense, embrace them on an external level before you can touch them on a deeper level. You have to warm them up to be receptive. You have to warm them up as students, and then you can teach. And so Rabba began his sessions, his lessons, with a humorous remark, and then he began teaching. The message for us in relationships, and with this we'll have an early end to the class today. We have our Hebrew school graduation, so we'll close it out with this. In every relationship, you have the same idea. There are things that are what we would call deeper connections, deeper communications, whether it's a serious conversation or whether it's a deeper connection on whatever level that is. You cannot start off with a deeper connection. It doesn't work like that. You have to warm up the other person. So if you're having, let's keep it simple and talk about a conversation, right? You want to have a heart-to-heart conversation with someone you love. You can't just jump into it. I don't know if you should start off necessarily with a joke, but maybe you could. I don't know. You have to warm the other person up. But you have something really important that you want to share. And it might be very important, and it's deep inside, and it needs to really hit the other person deeply inside. And so you think, what's the best way to do it? Let me just share and bare my soul and just tell you how I'm feeling. May not work. It may not work because you're starting off cold. It's a cold start. If you really want to touch someone, if you really want to deliver a message or deliver a feeling or deliver an idea or touch them in a deep place inside and get them to really understand you, if that's the objective, if you really want to connect on a deep level, you have to prepare them. It sounds like very, I don't mean for it to sound manipulative. It's not manipulative, but you have to set the stage for that connection. You have to create a connection before you connect. That's the point. You have to start off a conversation about maybe something silly, something not at all as deep and pressing. If you tell someone, okay, I need you to sit down, and we need to have a serious conversation, that's it. They're now closed and they're defensive. But you open them up and you say, you know, something fun and light and whatever, but that's not my point. I don't want to talk about that stuff. I have something really important to share. Okay, but that's not going to work without this. You need the external connection before you have the deeper connection. And this is true in every facet of a relationship. You can't have deeper connections without paving the way first by external connections. We're going to bring now another example, not now, but next week, not next week either, and not 2 weeks because that's Memorial Day. Okay, in a few weeks. The next time we meet, we're going to have another example of a parent connecting with a child. But it's true in loving relationships, and I think it's especially true in loving relationships, and let's not forget the context of this discourse. It's a marriage. And a marriage on many levels has deeper connections and more external connections. And the point here is you have to pave the way, so to speak. You have to prepare the other for a deeper connection by first having a more external connection. It's not even a shallow connection. It's still a connection, but you can't go in straight away. You can't connect in the deepest way immediately. You first have to prepare the ground, so to speak, or prepare the situation for the deeper connection. So again, if we keep it in a very simple example, in a relationship, with something very important to share, very necessary to share, very deep, maybe it's painful, maybe it's whatever, maybe it's not painful, but it's deep. You want to share it? That's wonderful. But don't forget the formula. You have to first create a connection on a basic level before you can create a deeper connection. You have to have step one before step two. But step one is shallow and it's going to be distracting. It's not going to be distracting. It's going to be, yeah.
What do you do when your rabbi is not so funny?
So you tell the joke. Right. Anyway, I think it's very important relationship advice on every level. You know, whether it's in dating or whether it's in marriage or whether it's with parents and children, children with parents, whatever it is. You want to have a connection. There are always moments in which there's a need for a deeper connection. You cannot have the deeper connection without a basic connection. You can't jump into the deeper connection, to the deeper conversation, without a basic connection. And even though you have a basic connection, because you're related or you're married or whatever it is, you have to reestablish it. Rabbah told the joke every day. It's not like, well, these are my students and I'm their teacher, so I can just jump right in today. I can't just jump right in today. I need to pave the way. I need to pave the ground today. Thank you. Thank you. All right, that's it for today. We have to wrap up. To run over to our new facility. Thank you very much for joining me for an abridged version of Kabbalah and Coffee. Hopefully, the message came through today. The value of comedy, the Kabbalah of comedy, and the value of preparing ourselves and others for relationships on a deeper level by first establishing a more seemingly external connection. Thank you very much for joining me today for Kabbalah and Coffee.